Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. The two-week countdown is underway before President Donald Trump says his administration will move forward with immigration raids in cities across the country unless Congress changes the asylum laws, which is doubtful. Who knows if Donald Trump is actually serious about such raids that he tweeted would result in a million deportations, but the threat of such actions alone is enough to spread fear throughout immigrant communities in the United States. This comes as Congress this week is also considering a spending measure that is supposedly meant to help alleviate the crisis in the centers where migrants seeking asylum have been detained. This comes as numerous news stories have shown that people are going without blankets, without toothbrushes, that there have been a number of deaths throughout these centers across the country, including that of children. There is a debate if these centers should be called concentration camps, and while they may not necessarily be Nazi concentration camps of World War II, according to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, which has a direct linkage to Noah Webster, who helped formalize American version of English, holding refugees in centers apart from the general population does count as a concentration camp. Now, before coming commonly known as internment camps for Japanese Americans in World War II, both FDR and Harry Truman referred to these camps as concentration camps. Today, we're going to spend the hour with a man who has lived at the U.S.-Mexican border practically all of his life, first growing up in California near the Tijuana border there, and then later he has dedicated his journalistic career to covering the border. Joining me here in the studio is John Carlos Frey. John Carlos Frey is a veteran investigative journalist. He has won numerous awards. His latest book is called Sand and Blood, America's Stealth War on the Mexico Border. John Carlos Frey, it is my good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I bet at least half of the country would believe and would say, if not more, that Trump and his administration's policies towards immigrants, undocumented immigrants, those who are seeking asylum, are brutal. And again, maybe even more people would believe that. Well, I like what you did, though, with this book, Sand and Blood, is you show that this actually doesn't come out of nowhere.
We have a history of marginalizing the other. We have a history of militarizing the border. We may think Trump is the worst example of that kind of tactic, and I believe that he is. But he's standing on the shoulders of previous administrations and laws. What he's doing on the border today, the way he treats migrants, the fact that he separates children from their parents, is legal. These were all laws that were on the books when he became president and came before him. So he wouldn't even be prosecuted for anything that he's doing today.
Yeah, important to point. And I guess you could even maybe say the same thing about Obama. And, you know, at one time, Obama was known as deporter in chief, and then he did some executive actions. But neither Obama or Trump have got any immigration legislation through. So both of them have been acting on laws previously passed.
I think it's a lot easier for a politician, or at least it seems like it's a lot easier for a politician, to scare people about immigrants, and they are the saviors. You know, these are bad, marauding criminals that are trying to get into the country and steal your jobs or commit crimes, and then I'm going to be your savior. That's easy to say on a stump speech. It's a lot more difficult to unscare people and to talk nuance and holistic approaches and comprehensive immigration reform. These are things I know that Obama certainly did try to pass, but he had a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House and didn't get it through. No. So he also signed bills that fortified the border. He also was the president who put the first basically concentration camps, if we're using that term, for families. He instituted family detention. Women with their children were housed in a couple of facilities in Texas.
Now, is that under existing law, or was there
Under Obama. He was the very first to put together family detention facilities because we started to see migrants from Central America bringing the entire family unit. Women with children is a phenomenon that's fairly recent.
Yeah. Tell me what's important to understand, and you dive into this, the 1990s. Well, in order to understand today and where we are, I think you would argue you got to understand what happened in the 90s.
Yeah, about 30 years ago, we started to see a large influx of people coming from Mexico primarily because there was economic depression. There was civil unrest. We saw people coming by the millions across the U.S.-Mexico border. Part of that was some of the trade policies that we had with Mexico. NAFTA was one where a lot of people in Mexico lost their jobs. It's estimated that when NAFTA was signed, 2 million corn farmers lost their jobs because we subsidized corn in the United States to such a degree that it's too expensive to grow corn in Mexico, a staple crop. People started buying, or Mexico started buying their corn from the United States because it was cheaper. So 2 million corn farmers from one day to the next didn't have work. They came to the United States. We started to see
inflation
this.
Inflation was crazy.
Inflation was crazy.
In Mexico. I mean, this was a serious economic time in the 1990s for Mexico.
It was almost like the perfect storm in the negative. Yeah. Inflation was crazy. The jobless rate went through the roof. Crime started to increase. There were assassination of leaders in the Mexican government. People started to get scared, felt that their country was being destabilized, and so they fled. This is common. Migration is part of human phenomenon. When your country is going downhill, people want to leave and look for a better life. We saw people coming to the border by the millions. Politicians jumped in and called them invaders, marauders, criminals. That sort of thing was part of a political platform. And laws started to be instituted to block these individuals. The Border Patrol numbers escalated as far as how many people were in the Border Patrol force. Fences started to be built. We started to fortify the border in a much more militaristic style.
And this is something you saw firsthand. You've lived near the border.
I grew up on the border. Yeah. My family home, where my sister lives today, I can see the border fence itself. I can walk a few hundred yards. I can hear Mexico from where I grew up. I can hear cars and music. I can smell sometimes trash fires. It was that close, the border was, and there was no fence when I grew up. Today, if I go back to the very same region that I grew up, there's a triple layer fence. There are three fences that separate the United States from Mexico. There are border guards all over the place. There's a helicopter that flies in the air 24/7. They have Humvees, night vision detectors, motion detectors, all kinds of surveillance equipment at the U.S.-Mexico border for economic migrants, for the most part. From what I understand, these are not people that are coming over armed. They're not an invasion. They are not coming in tanks. These are people looking for a job. And we've approached this issue, this problem, with militaristic force. That's what the book is about. We are trying to solve a problem of necessity, a problem of desperation, with the military.
Tell me what that was like as a kid then, living at a border that had no fence, really no barrier to keep people from going back and forward.
I was never afraid of these people. These people were my friends. I used to hike in the hills in and around where the border line actually is. There's even a park called Friendship Park where you could go meet relatives and friends and have a picnic with people from Mexico without having to cross a border. It was a friendly place. It was a place.
There's a fence now there, right?
Oh, there's not only a fence. There's a wall.
Yeah.
You can't get across. You can't touch the other person through the wall. There's actually separation so that cars can drive through. There is no Friendship Park left. There's a park, but there's nothing friendly about it. There are Border Patrol agents on standby at that park 24/7.
So when there were no barriers, did people just come and go freely? And I guess if that was the case, then I can imagine a situation where people crossed the border just to come, came to the United States just for work, and then when the workday was over, we'd go back home.
One of the problems we see today is that we have a swelling of migrants staying in the United States because it's become too dangerous and too difficult to cross. People used to come for the harvest. They'd work in the fields, they'd make a little bit of money, and they'd go back to their families. And there was an ebb and flow of migration. Today, if you get across the U.S.-Mexico border and you make it, in quotes, you're going to stay. And then you're going to send for your family so you can reunify. And so the undocumented population in the United States is growing because we have fortified the border.
Tell me about the fear of immigration then that we saw in the 1990s.
I think that the fear of immigrants was perpetrated by politicians. We had a governor in California at the time by the name of Pete Wilson, who actually ran for president of the United States as well. His numbers were trailing. He was falling back in the polls, and he saw this influx of migrants. He backed a law, Proposition 187, which we're all very familiar with here in California, which would ban any undocumented immigrant from receiving social services. It would require teachers to ask for kids' proof of legal residency, or they couldn't attend public school. If you wanted to check out...
required teachers and social workers to report kids, right?
To report, to become immigration agents.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Even a librarian, if she or he suspected that somebody checking out a book in a public library was, quote, undocumented, I don't know how you can determine that by how somebody looks, but I'm assuming it was a brown person that you would ask, you could call immigration officials and have that person arrested if they were suspected. The reason that we don't have driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants in most states across the country is because of these kinds of punitive laws. Pete Wilson ran on a campaign of invaders, criminals, people taking your jobs, draining social services, and his numbers started to tick up in the polls. He needed a boogeyman. He needed a bad guy to demonize, and he chose immigrants, and he became governor of California.
Yeah, that's interesting, because he was trailing Kathleen Brown.
He was trailing by over 20 points at the time.
Yeah.
And he won the governorship based on his decision to use undocumented immigrants as something to stand on. I can see the same political model with President Trump today. He throws red meat to his base by build the wall, and they all scream in approval.
Yeah. Now, did Pete Wilson at one point then switch and turn his attention there? He wasn't always that anti-immigrant politician?
He claims personally that he was never anti-immigrant, that these were laws that were necessary, that he saw a serious problem and he figured that Proposition 187 was the solution. He never claims that this was a political stunt on his behalf.
But it worked. Nonetheless, whatever it was, he became governor. I mean, Proposition 187, I remember I was in college at the time. At San Francisco State University, I was in my own bubble. I was like, oh, there's no way this is going to pass. Everyone's against it. And it passes with, I think, over 60% of the vote.
I think California always seems to be a good test market for how politics works. And it sort of shows up 20 or 30 years later on the national scene. Yeah. We sort of go through it first. And I think what we're seeing today with this current administration is what California went through 25 years ago.
Let's hope the backlash also comes.
Well, look at our state legislature today. We have Latinos. We have Mexican Americans. I mean, you couldn't pass an anti-immigrant law in this state if you tried. And anybody who runs on that ticket is going to fail. I do believe that the tide is turning, and this is a last gasp effort, at least from this administration. I think that they will never be able to do this again.
Now, the courts struck down Proposition 187, basically saying immigration is the business of the federal government. But Proposition 187 was one of the most nastiest legislations you'll ever see. It was a proposition, but...
It did pass, but the courts gutted it, and the courts didn't allow it to be implemented, and there wasn't any real implementation of Proposition 187, but it did have ripple effects. There were other states throughout the years that have tried to pass similar punitive measures, and usually by a politician trying to run on the backs of the undocumented or vilifying undocumented immigrants. I can point to Alabama, Georgia, Wisconsin, Arizona had some punitive measures as well. They were all modeled after Proposition 187.
We're not just talking about Republicans here in the 1990s. Democrats were also getting on the bandwagon, on the anti-immigrant bandwagon, including probably the most important Democrat of the 1990s, Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton's legacy with respect to immigration is one of a restrictive-minded, policy-oriented president. He probably passed more restrictive laws with respect to immigration than any other president. He used welfare laws. He used quotas. He used, I think at the time he passed a law that wouldn't allow any legal resident. If you were an immigrant and you were in this country for less than 5 years, you would not be able to receive any sort of welfare benefits. You had to wait 5 years. That law is still on the books. He did not pass any sort of comprehensive immigration reform. If anything, he restricted the legal pass of immigrants into the United States. He ran on a very anti-immigrant ticket, and he's the first president to start to build border walls. He instituted a policy called prevention through deterrence. This was in 1994, and it was a policy that was agreed upon by the U.S. Border Patrol, basically saying, we're never going to stop everybody from coming, but let's make the journey really dangerous. Let's make the journey very difficult. Let's make border walls, let's put border walls in front of cities and force migration through deserts and mountains. That's Bill Clinton. It has his signature on that policy. And that's why we started to see people starting to die in our deserts and in our mountains, was because of this deterrence strategy that we still see today.
In 1996, we get the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act. Just the title itself sounds harsh.
Another restrictive policy. You know, there were people in his administration, including the head of the INS at the time, who was Doris Meisner, who said, border security is important. We do need border guards. We don't know who's coming, and we don't know what they may be bringing in. There was a scare of drugs coming across the border. There was a scare of a criminal element coming across. But you just can't seal it off. You also have to have some form of immigration reform. You have to maybe relax visas, get more worker visas, allow a path for legalization to become easier. That was not done. It was punitive. Bill Clinton's laws were punitive and restrictive. They were not easing up at all. All we did was just seal people off from coming into the United States.
Now, was it that you had a Republican-controlled House of Representatives, a very aggressive new leadership in the House that sort of sometimes people say, including with welfare reform, Clinton didn't have much of a choice because he had these Republicans and he had to find some kind of compromise? Or do you feel like Democrats were fully on board with this? I believe Joe Biden, I mean, if we're talking about today's candidates, I did look at today's candidates who were around there. There's only two, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. Joe Biden supported this 1996 bill.
Dianne Feinstein did. Hillary Clinton did as well as supported. Dianne Feinstein, one of her first campaign promises was to make the border tougher. You know, she ran on the backs of these immigrants. I don't know necessarily that Clinton had to go in this route. I think he chose this route. It was politically expedient. If he was tough on immigrants, listen, if you have a criminal element, which is how they're portrayed, and they're going to invade you, and you don't do something about it as president, then you're not a good president. So he had to look tough, and it scored points.
Let's not lose sight of Dianne Feinstein. You did mention her, but here we are in the Bay Area. Former mayor of San Francisco. She was very tough.
She did approve of increased in border security, increased in infrastructure, increase in militarization. She had a campaign ad that basically
she used it to run for Senate.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That she was going to be tough on the border, which is a line that Donald Trump can use today, being tough on the border. She has changed her tune. She's an advocate for DACA. She's an advocate for comprehensive immigration reform. But her history isn't so clean that way. It is politically expedient. Maybe less so today, but it was politically expedient in the 90s to be tough on immigrants. I'm not quite sure what that means, especially if the immigrants, for the most part, are poor. We're talking about being tough on the marginalized. We're being tough on poor people. That's what was really going on, but that's not how they were portrayed.
And again, just to point out what you've already said, but to underline it, things that Donald Trump is doing today was made possible from policies from this era.
You can take a look at a State of the Union speech from Bill Clinton in 1995, where he says we're going to root out, I'm paraphrasing, but we're going to root out illegal aliens. We're going to go after them. We're going to deport them. We're going to make the border tougher and stronger. We're going to hire more border guards. This sounds like a stump speech by Trump. This was a Democratic president who was talking about how tough he was going to be on the border. Fast forward almost 30 years, and we're still doing the same thing. We're militarizing. We do have a war on the border that has been undeclared.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with John Carlos Frey, who's an award-winning veteran investigative reporter. His latest book is called Sand and Blood, America's Stealth War on the Mexican Border. For our listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, John Carlos Frey will be speaking tonight at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley. That's tonight at 7:30 p.m. At St. John's Presbyterian Church, which is 2727 College Avenue. Again, it is a KPFA-sponsored event. We will give these details out again as the show proceeds. Let's turn to the Bush administration. the George W. Bush administration, he was never able to get comprehensive immigration through Congress, but there were many, especially in the days after the 9/11 attacks, many things that did happen, including the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, that would affect immigration policies.
This is where I think that the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border, if you compare it to the 90s and to decades prior, grew from sort of a steroid approach. It just exponentially grew. You're right. We did get the Department of Homeland Security. The U.S. Border Patrol size of the force was about 8,000, 9,000 individuals. We're now at 20,000. That was a doubling of the U.S. Border Patrol by the Bush administration. We got 700 miles of border fence, extra border fence. The budget of the U.S. Border Patrol went from $1 billion to $4 billion. That's a quadrupling of the budget of the U.S. Border Patrol. And most of what we did was militarization. There was an understanding that there was a porous border and that Al-Qaeda, who attacked us on 9/11, could come through Tijuana, could come through El Paso carrying dirty bombs. This was actually rhetoric. These were discussions that were being had in the administration, and people started to get scared. So we had to protect all of our borders. We had to protect our oceans. We had to protect us from who knows where the attack was coming from. And there was a zeal to seal off that border by using U.S. military might.
We have a term, military-industrial complex, but during this period of time, during this Bush administration, the years of his presidency, I started hearing another term, the Homeland Security-industrial complex.
It's hard to determine whether or not we had a necessity at the border because there was a viable threat or there was lobbying. There was defense contractors telling us that we needed to seal the border, that we needed this kind of equipment, because defense contractors are going to move in and supply. If you're going to double the size of the U.S. Border Patrol, who's going to supply the uniforms and the guns and the tanks and the Humvees that they all drive and the Black Hawk helicopters? These are things that are at the border. We now have drones at the U.S.-Mexico border, drones to watch what poor farm workers come across. These are multi-million dollar planes that are flown over the U.S.-Mexico border. I believe that the effort to increase the budget was by defense contractor lobbyists, because at the border, Lockheed sells wares and Raytheon and Boeing. This is basically a new front, not on the war on terror, but the war on migrants, fueled by defense contractors.
Tell me about the group FAIR, and this would become a pretty prominent member. I guess it was prominent in the 90s too, but certainly during the Bush years.
FAIR is an organization. It's an acronym, F-A-I-R, that stands for the Federation for Americans for Immigration Reform. It sounds like a think tank. If you take a look at it, it looks like a credible organization that is concerned about migration, the population growth in the United States, and allowing people to come and go from the United States, immigrants. It is an organization concerned with the issue of immigration, usually touted by the right. Its founder, who is John Stanton, is a known white supremacist, and advocates for the limitation of immigration rights, advocates for the limitation of immigrants coming to the United States. Every paper, every report, every document, every kind of research that they do basically tells the United States government that we don't need any more immigrants, that we ought to block us off from the rest of the world. And that's the research, and those are the documents that the government cites as their reporting. So this is an organization founded by white supremacists who don't want to allow brown people into the United States.
I mean, their fellows will testify at Congress.
They have testified in Congress. Their reports have been implemented as law by the U.S. government. They were the first progenitors of the border walls that we have today. They drew up schemes. They drew up blueprints. And these plans and ideas have been implemented by the U.S. government. It is a way to keep America white.
Tell me about the genesis and how we start to see, because you have your areas where you had a lot of crossing historically, the border, and then the U.S. stops the crossing there and forces people, if they are going to cross, to go through much more treacherous, much more dangerous terrain.
There's a diagram that was generated by the U.S. Border Patrol, commissioned by George H.W. Bush and followed through by Bill Clinton, to see how we're going to keep people from coming, slow down migration, illegal immigration across the U.S.-Mexico border. And the plan was, by Customs and Border Protection, the way we refer to them today, was to limit access to the major cities, El Paso, San Diego, Nogales, places in Texas as well, in southern Texas, along the border, to block off the cities, because if a migrant's going to cross the border, they can hide in big cities. Let's open up the deserts. Let's open up the mountains. Let's open up the vast terrain of the American Southwest and allow them to access the United States from there, because that will be the deterrent that we can use. We can use the heat of the desert. The fact that a migrant would have to walk 3, 4, 5 days just to reach a town or a telephone or access to water or a road, that will deter migrants from coming. So we basically built fences across these large cities that are along the U.S.-Mexico border, and we did not fence off the mountains and the deserts. And we said, go for it, basically. In these documents that basically co-sign this kind of migration, the U.S. Border Patrol knew that people were going to be dehydrated. They prepared for it. They warned Border Patrol agents that people are going to die. We see thousands of deaths. Now, we've recovered thousands of bodies along these routes. The plan is very effective. It does make the journey harder, but it didn't keep a desperate migrant from coming. They're still coming, and they're still dying.
The government knew this would result in
deaths.
They
still know. They still know.
But when they're implementing it, I mean, that was, you know, well, it wasn't something they figured out later on.
The deterrent strategy is this. Let's make the journey for a migrant as hellish as possible. Let's even have them risk their own life, because nobody in their right mind would risk their life for a job. That's what they thought. They thought that the deterrent strategy wouldn't necessarily kill a migrant, because they wouldn't risk their life. They would see the desert, they would see it would be 110 degrees, and a logical person would say, I can't make this journey. A desperate person is the person who does make it.
Yeah. Talk to me about, you have a very interesting story in the book about Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter from San Diego, probably from the area, near the area where you were from.
Yeah.
Known for his anti-immigration positions. Also, I think very powerful on the Armed Services Committee during the the Bush years. I remember covering him when I was a Capitol Hill reporter. Tell me about the story about who why he's important. And then also, where this really gets interesting, his brother.
Congressman Duncan Hunter, whose son is actually a congressman today
as
well.
Holds his seat, I think, yeah.
Yeah, it is his son, the one who's embroiled in this controversy of embezzling campaign funds. You know, I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Congressman Duncan Hunter in the 90s was known as the border wall congressman. He did have his district that butted up right near the U.S.-Mexico border, and he wanted to fence it off. He wanted a clean, sharp line across the U.S.-Mexico border to keep us from them, and he advocated for it and lobbied for it. And he also was a candidate for president during Obama's first run as well, during the primaries. And he ran solely on build a border wall, build it stronger, build it bigger, and that was his campaign
that
promise.
Was his campaign.
He ran
2008.
He could have been Donald Trump, say, wow, let's, we're going to build a wall.
Yeah,
he sort of started that whole kind of a chant.
And you went to go visit him in his office.
I went to visit him in his office. He had photographs of the border before we had a border wall. He had photographs after we did get a border wall in San Diego. And he tried to prove to me how much better it was now that we had a wall, because there wasn't trash and there wasn't broken bottles and there wasn't this disheveled fence. Now he had this sort of structure that he could see delineated one country from the next. I asked him, because at the time the walls had been in place for about 10 years, migration had been shifted to the deserts of California, and migrants had begun to die because there was border security blocking Tijuana from San Diego, which was a very popular route for migrants, a very safe place to cross. Migrants were dying by the hundreds in the deserts. And I asked him, I said, well, do you feel responsible because you advocated for this wall and you forced migration to the deserts and people are dying? Do you feel responsible for these individuals' deaths? He said, absolutely not. Let's build a wall in the deserts.
Yeah, he wanted to put a wall in the mountains and everything. He was just for more wall.
If people are dying in the deserts, let's put a wall there. If they're drowning by canals, let's put a wall near the canal. If they're dying in the mountains, let's wall off the mountains. He felt that the wall was the solution for everything. The strange part of this story is that his brother, who at the time when he was running for Congress every 2 years, was his campaign manager and raised money for his campaigns and got him elected and got him reelected. And the fact that this man, Congressman Duncan Hunter, kept advocating for these walls, forcing migration to the deserts, John began to realize.
John Hunter, that's
John his Hunter, I'm sorry. Yeah. John Hunter was his brother, began to realize that the policies that he was supporting by helping his brother raise money for his campaigns, was killing people. He actually was the very first person in the country, John Hunter, Duncan Hunter's brother, was the first person in the country to put water out for migrants. He started to study migration routes. He started to look at footprints and where people left backpacks in areas that were not fenced off and where there was little border security, where migrants were dying. And he started an organization called Water Stations. He got a group of volunteers, his family mostly, and every weekend they'd go out in the desert in the heat and they'd put out gallon jugs of water in routes in areas where migrants were known to die to try and save lives. So he did the exact opposite of what his brother did. He knew that his brother had forced migration routes to the deserts and he was trying to save lives now. He did feel guilty that he had some hand in these new policies that forced migration eastward.
That's really fascinating.
It's crazy.
Fascinating story. Well, what's his position? I mean, has his whole position on immigration changed or just... How the strategy at the border?
John Hunter is a rocket scientist.
Yeah.
He's actually a real rocket scientist and has designed weaponry for the U.S. government. And he believes wholeheartedly that most of the people that are coming across are poor farmers, are people who don't have any other recourse. He understands migration probably like you and I do. And he is a humanitarian. He just doesn't want people to die. And he's still involved.
John Carlos Frey is our guest. John Carlos Frey is award-winning investigative journalist. His book is called Sand and Blood, America's Stealth War on the Mexico Border. For listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, John Carlos Frey will be speaking tonight in Berkeley at St. John's Presbyterian Church, which is located at 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley. So that's tonight at 7:30. It is a KPFA-sponsored event. Miguel Guerrero will be the host of that event. I'll give these details again as we wrap up the show in about 15 minutes or so. John Carlos Frey, I want to be careful here. As we talk about the changes that have happened in the 90s and have continued to change in the militarization of the border, it doesn't, and how you were saying earlier when you were younger, people came sort of pretty freely back and forward. I don't want to give listeners the impression, though, that it was always that way, that it was always so easy to go back and forward and, you know, people just did it, you know, leisurely, that there were troubling things in the past.
There's always been a disparity between the United States and Mexico. There's always been an understanding that Mexicans are dirty, that Mexicans need to be guarded, that Mexicans need to be looked after and watched carefully. In the turn of the 20th century, we had a typhus scare in El Paso, Texas. Typhus is a disease that's passed on by blood-borne insects, ticks, and lice. And it was believed that Mexicans were bringing over this disease, typhus. And the governor of El Paso at the time convinced the U.S. Health Department to put up a quarantine station at the port of entry between Juarez and El Paso. This was in the early 19-teens. And people who used to work in the United States daily, this was a very common occurrence in El Paso, which is right next to Mexico, people would come for work, housekeepers and gardeners and people who would work construction jobs, just like we see today, would cross the U.S.-Mexico border, go to work for the day, and go back to their homes in Mexico. This was a daily occurrence, and it was fairly easy to get across. You just needed some sort of an ID, and you could get in. And there weren't long lines, but when this typhus scare hit, they decided, the mayor of El Paso decided that Mexicans needed to be quarantined. every single day. It was sort of like if you get on an airplane, you have to go through TSA and go through security and empty your pockets and put your suitcase through. It's that kind of a stringent security. But in this case, people had to strip naked.
Yeah.
People had to take off all of their clothes. They had to dip in some sort of a de-lousing bath naked in front of guards. Their clothes had to be steamed, and they could put their clothes back on the other side, and then they could go to work. This was a daily occurrence.
What was a de-lousing bath?
A de-lousing bath is a chemical process by which you dip your entire body into this chemical so that if you do have any sort of lice on your body, they're killed by the chemical. This had to be every day. If you've had lice that were found in your hair, for example, your head had to be shaved. And then you could get into the United States. This was a daily occurrence.
You had to dip your body into chemicals.
Kerosene was the major component.
That killed basically anything on your body.
That's correct.
Yeah.
This was daily. This is the passage that you needed in order to gain access to the United States. This didn't just happen in El Paso. This happened at other ports of entry as well because of this typhus scare. And this is where the term dirty, lousy Mexicans comes from, because Mexicans were at least purported to be the carriers of this typhus. It was never proven. There wasn't any accounts of Mexicans spreading this disease. There weren't accounts of Mexicans in Mexico spreading typhus. This was just a scare tactic by the mayor at the time, but there were quarantine stations until there was a protest by one individual who didn't want to do it anymore.
And that one individual, and this is a remarkable story, this is January 28th, 1917, and her name is Carmelita Torres.
Carmelita Torres was in line one more time. A 17-year-old housekeeper for a wealthy family in El Paso would have to go through this process every single day. She had heard that people were taking photographs of her nude body and other women as they came across, and they were being posted in local bars for men to gawk at. And she had had enough. She just said one day, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to strip naked for anybody. She got a couple of other women in line with her to join forces. And there was a major protest, and they shut down that port of entry. As a matter of fact, they decided to not go through the ports of entry anymore. They decided to enter in to go to work illegally. They went around the ports of entry through open land and decided not to be inspected that way any longer. They were dehumanized.
Was the military called in, or some armed force was called in?
Local Fort Bragg is in El Paso, and soldiers from Fort Bragg were brought to silence the protest.
Yeah. And they're known as the Bath Riots.
These are known as the Bath Riots, and Carmelita is sometimes referred to as the Mexican Rosa Parks, who decided to not tolerate it anymore. But this is the way that we've treated Mexicans and people from Latin America for over a century now, at least.
I have to admit, before spending time with your book, I had never heard of Carmelita Torres. I'm sure I'm not alone.
No, it's not
but
a very popular story.
Called the Rosa Parks of...
By people, you know, this area of the border is its own country, and stories of who these individuals are and their strifes and their difficulties and their triumphs usually don't make it to national media. We don't hear stories about the people who are coming themselves. We can marginalize them, criminalize them, point our fingers at them, even call them terrorists, but they don't get to speak up for themselves. So it's sort of what I've dedicated my career to doing, is sort of illuminate that struggle and who these individuals are.
So when we talk about the military, in this case, coming to try to break up these quote-unquote bath riots, and you write the military was not successful in being able to do that. They eventually just stopped the baths. Is that what happened?
Well, the program was instituted for almost another 40 years. There were quarantine stations up and down the U.S.-Mexico border for decades after.
And people still had to undress and
people still had to undress 100% naked in front of a guard, dip themselves into a chemical bath, have their clothes steamed, and then they were free to go into the United States.
Well, what happens 40 years later? And I don't know if I'm getting the exact math right, but I'm now thinking sort of the mid-1960s when we actually start to see some progressive laws concerning immigration.
And we needed labor.
Yeah.
We needed people coming to pick our crops.
Yeah.
You know, we needed farm workers, and we needed them by the millions, and we invited them to come, called the Bracero Program, where we actually invited almost 5 million Mexican farm workers to come and pick crops.
And so this is after World War II, then?
That's correct.
That happens, yeah.
Right, and that program was ended in the 60s.
Yeah. And then I guess what I was referring to, but I guess my math was off because you were saying the Bracero program, which predates this. But in 1965, we do get the Immigration and Nationality Act that undoes quotas based on race. Oftentimes, I think when we think of the major pieces of legislation concerning of the 1960s, people think of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. But it could be argued that the Immigration Nationality Act of 1965 should be right there with those.
I would certainly agree with that. And, you know, advocating on behalf of immigrants, that might be the last time with the exception of Ronald Reagan's amnesty. It isn't popular. It was popular then because we had such a large population and we needed labor. We needed people in this country. We needed to find a way to do it legally. We still need the labor, but we're not willing to recognize that we need a legal process by which they come.
How significant was Ronald Reagan's amnesty? And it's a mixed bag, isn't it?
It is a mixed bag. If you take a look at just the amnesty program was to do several things. It was to legalize a population of individuals in the United States that could prove that they had legal residency for a period of time and that they had a job. If you had a job and had been in the United States for a period of time, you could get legal status. That's number one. So the undocumented population in the United States had a pathway. But in addition to that, it was supposed to make the border tighter. It was supposed to go after employers who were hiring the undocumented. Those parts never really happened. And that's what Republicans today keep screaming at. They believe that the amnesty, quote, amnesty program was just to legalize U.S. residents at the time. The fact that employers were never sanctioned for hiring undocumented was on purpose. Because the agricultural industry basically said, you're going to put us out of business if you start coming after us.
Right.
So that part of it has never really been implemented at all.
Going back to the militarization of the border and the use of the actual military at the border, how does the, you write about this, the Posse Comitatus Act works. And this is from the previous century, and which basically says the U.S. military is not to operate within the borders unless some type of an extraordinary thing happened, an emergency happened.
We're not supposed to use the U.S. military as a police force.
No.
Within the confines of the United States. This is not a police state. Military is used for theaters of war and for combat, which we don't have at our borders. If we did have some sort of a military threat south of the border, then of course the military would be able to defend it. But we're not supposed to use them as de facto police. But indeed, those laws have been lax. We have used the military. The government sends the National Guard to the border whenever it deems necessary. And we do have troops on the border today.
And the border's interesting because they're with a certain distance from the border, sort of considered this quasi-constitutional area where the Constitution doesn't always apply.
Well, it's supposed to. It is.
I mean, I think about if somebody were to be detained here in Berkeley, they would have a certain amount of rights. You just couldn't grab them and immediately take them over the border. But if it's done like within a few miles, maybe even 100 miles, I could be off.
The U.S. Border Patrol operates within 100 miles, and then ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, operates anywhere north of that. There have been arguments about the constitutionality of pulling somebody over and asking them for proof of legal residency, but we have given our U.S. Customs and Border officials that prerogative, even more so since the Patriot Act, since 9/11. It's a free-for-all. I mean, we can violate people's human rights, violate their civil rights, violate their constitutional rights, and nobody is prosecuted. What Donald Trump is doing today by separating children, by incarcerating children, by putting them in detention facilities for months on end, violating all kinds of constitutional rights, the Fourth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, the ACLU has argued for years that these are violations of our Constitution. They're not winning any cases.
They're not winning those cases.
No, this is status quo, and there aren't cases that are being adjudicated in favor of migrants.
Do you know what the difficulty is, in legally speaking, with these cases?
Oh, God, it's so complex. I can tell one off the top of my head, a young boy who was shot and killed by a Border Patrol agent standing on the U.S. side. The Border Patrol agent fired his weapon into Mexico, killed a 15-year-old boy who was unarmed. And because the boy was standing in Mexico, the family of the deceased boy was not able to bring suit.
Because they had him standing?
Because he was in Mexico.
Yeah.
They were 30 feet apart. but the fact that the boy was standing on Mexican soil does not give Mexican nationals any right to sue the federal government for wrongful death. And, I mean, these kinds of laws go on and on. We've also given quite a big wide berth for national security. The U.S.-Mexico border now is considered to be an area where there is a national threat. Possible terrorism. The U.S. Border Patrol motto today is defending us from possible terrorists and weapons of mass destruction. This gives the federal government all kinds of leeway to protect us and defend our borders from a militaristic approach. So violations of constitutional law are rampant because there's basically nobody being prosecuted.
And that's what seems so wild to me. If Mexico's our neighbor, probably our most important friend, we are probably more integrated both culturally and economically with Mexico than any other country.
I would agree with that, and I'd also like to know if we have a militaristic approach to immigration. I don't know who the enemy is. For the most part, these people are not armed. They don't have weapons of war. There aren't planes flying on the Mexico side surveilling us, but we're doing that to them. I'd say the Border Patrol statistics are that 99% of the people who cross the U.S.-Mexico border without papers are economic migrants. So these are people coming for a job. So I don't know why we need tanks at the border and why we need the military at the border and why we need drones at the border if these are people in search of a job. The military might doesn't seem
to... Well, people
are
going to say they're taking jobs and now their jobs are not available for Americans, and that's why.
Well, I argue that point too, because I don't know necessarily that a migrant coming because he's hungry or poor really has the authority to take a U.S. citizen's job. It's the employer who gives that job to the migrant, and that's the person who should be scrutinized. If they're hiring undocumented labor, they're probably profiting and benefiting off of that person. So I think that the scrutiny should really be with the employers, who are basically free to do it.
So you do write that while the United States is militarizing the border, it doesn't actually do anything to address the cause of migration into the United States. What would you do? How do you address that? And oftentimes you hear like, well, economics and these things, but how feasible are those things?
They're not easy.
Yeah.
Migration is complex, and the reasons that people come are varied. Most people come for a myriad of reasons. It's not just one thing. I always say to myself, imagine what it would take me to leave my home, to leave my friends, to leave my family, to leave everything I know, to leave my language, and to go to a foreign country where I don't know the customs, the language, where I don't qualify for work, where my education, if I have a degree or a skill, probably isn't going to work because I don't have a license to practice. So in order for me to migrate, it has to be a pretty desperate act. So I think that focus on those acts of desperation is where we need to start. I also think that if we need workers here, which is why most people are coming, why don't we legalize that process? Why don't we give people a work visa? Why don't we give them a card so that they can come and harvest in our fields and go back to their families in the off season? To streamline it, to know who's coming and to know who's going. Canada has a very robust immigration system agreement with Mexico. They don't have enough people in the country of Canada to harvest their crops in the summertime. They fly people from Mexico, farm workers from Mexico. They put them on planes and they send them to the fields in Canada. They house them. They feed them. They take Social Security taxes out. They're allowed to retire. They're allowed to retire with benefits. They treat them with dignity and with respect. And they don't have an illegal labor force. For the most part, everybody's on the books. We don't want to do that because the agricultural industry here profits off of the labor of undocumented workers.
Well, that's very interesting. I can't help but think, though, is it on the same scale?
No, not even close.
And if that presents difficulties.
Of course it does.
Yeah.
But we have the wherewithal to legalize this force. There's no political will to legalize a labor force. Any bill...
I never even hear that being talked about.
Well, why wouldn't it be? If we have 2 million farm workers in the San Joaquin Valley, very close to where we are right now, that are undocumented, why isn't there a push to legalize that? Because then you'd have to pay them workers' compensation. You'd have to pay them overtime. You'd have to take taxes out, maybe health benefits. If they get sick or hurt on the job, you're going to have to pay for that as well. If they're undocumented, you don't have to do any of that. I was hired for a report that I was doing as a farm worker in picking grapes, and I wanted to see what the process was. I didn't have to show proof of anything. I didn't have to show an ID. I didn't have to have any sort of a background check. I didn't have to sign any documents. I was just brought onto the farm, and I was told to go to work.
When was this?
2 years ago. This is still going on. This is how the labor force, when you need a mass of humanity to pick your crops during the harvest time, anybody's welcome. We're going to look the other way. Just do your job and we'll pay you at the end of the week. No regulations, no oversight, no background checks, no tax ID numbers, no driver's license, nothing. Just come to work. And that's how we do it.
If you were to legalize this labor force, would that mean that people would be able to come back and go back and forward again?
Sure. Why not?
Freely. But right now, migration across the border from Mexicans is low. It's down, right? It's a different situation.
Today we're seeing...
We talk about the people coming from Central America that are seeking asylum.
60% of the undocumented immigrants and asylum seekers are coming from Central America. And I reported last year that one of the contributing factors, and an escalating one, is climate change. This is an area that's mostly agricultural, from the countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and people are losing their crops and they're going hungry. People are starving. The United Nations in 2019 in February deemed 2.1 million people in this region food insecure. They cannot make a living enough to feed their families. I talked to farmers who were living on one tortilla a day. So now we're starting to see the effects of climate change at our borders. People are fleeing because they're hungry and they're knocking on our doors for food. As a matter of fact, the Trump administration last year reduced the amount of dollars sent to Central America for food aid. So we're exacerbating the problem by not alleviating it. Instead of sealing the border, why not have some of the funds go for a food program, for a jobs program, for an anti-crime program? These things would help to keep people in country.
John Carlos Frey has been our guest. He is the author of the book Sand and Blood, America's Stealth War on the Mexico Border. For our listeners in San Francisco Bay Area, John Carlos Frey will be speaking tonight in Berkeley at St. John's Presbyterian Church. That's located at 2727 College Avenue. It's a KPFA-sponsored event that begins tonight at 7:30. John Carlos Frey, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.